This is Edinburgh Student Radio Station.
I would listen to this.
This is Fresh Air.
Good evening, everyone. It has just gone 6 o'clock on Thursday, the 2nd of December, and you are listening to the Fresh Air News Hour with me, Ollie Lewis, Fresh Air's Head of News. We have a very special show for you today, one I'm looking forward to, so here's what's coming up. Oh, it's great to be back on air. There is a real buzz of stress around campus, isn't there? So in an attempt to remove our attention from uni work, today we have a special episode, a news and political review of 2021. Speeches, the interviews, the front page scoops. It's been a year in which a lot has happened and a lot has changed. We're going to be reliving it all. But of course, I have had some fantastic co-hosts this semester on the Fresh Air News Hour. And today, again, I'm not alone. I'm joined in the studio by Samuel McLeod. Samuel, welcome to the Fresh Air News Hour.
Hello, I'm happy to be here.
Pleasure to have you with us. So we're going to be bringing you our reflections on this year in politics and what could be more appropriate alongside that than celebrating some of the best new music releases of this year. Well, at least in our eyes. All of that coming up on the show, a packed show, but just before we get into it, we'll get some news headlines in just a moment. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel has announced new restrictions to be placed on unvaccinated people in the country. Those without jabs will be only allowed to meet with two other people outside their household and will be banned from restaurants, cultural venues and non-essential shops. Angela Merkel's successor, Olaf Scholz, backs the move, and the German parliament is likely to shortly be asked to approve mandatory vaccination in the country from February 2022. Here in the UK, Prime Minister Boris Johnson has insisted that whilst precautions such as mask wearing and increasing ventilation should be taken, the government do not expect people to alter their social behaviour to limit the spread of coronavirus. It follows a week of mixed messaging after senior government scientist Dr. Jenny Harries suggested Christmas parties and other unnecessary social contact should be avoided. A number of countries, including South Africa, have been added to the red list for travel in reaction to the discovery of the new COVID-19 variant, Omicron. Two people have been found guilty of the murder of six-year-old boy Arthur Labino Hughes. The child's father and his partner were convicted of manslaughter at Coventry Crown Court. The pair are thought to have mentally and physically abused the six-year-old prior to his death. CCTV showing distressing footage of Hughes was shown to the court. And finally, the Duchess of Sussex, Meghan Markle, has won an appeal against the Mail on Sunday's publisher. The newspaper published a private letter from Markle to her father back in 2018. A spokesperson for Associated Newspapers said it would further appeal the case and was disappointed by the outcome. The Duchess called it a win, not just for me, but for anyone who has ever felt scared to stand up for what's right. It's 10 minutes past six. Well, good evening. Oh, it is so nice to be back on air. I've been off for a few weeks. It is right in the middle of exam season, which of course you will know if you are a student at the University of Edinburgh. And so what better way to get a bit of light-ish relief? Looking back on 2021, a year in politics and news that has been pretty much just as phenomenal as the year that preceded it. And as I said in my introduction, I'm not alone in doing this and I'm joined by Samuel. Welcome.
Hello, it's great to be back here.
Yeah,
I've been in the news show for 2 years.
So do you have your own show on Fresh Air? Just for listeners, you are actually station manager?
Station manager,
you're my boss.
Yeah, so, I wouldn't put it like that. Yeah.
Do you have your own show at the moment?
I don't,
you
no.
You don't, okay.
No, not since 2019.
Not since 2019, okay. Exciting stuff to have you in the studio then. Very exciting. So we're going to do this in a sort of awards show format, aren't we?
Okay.
Kind of best interview, best scoop, all that kind of thing. Because when I just sort of roughly thought what I want to talk about for each of these categories, it kind of reminded me of honestly how much has gone on this year, and stories that happened in sort of February or March of this year just seemed like an age ago, because of course we started the year in complete lockdown and life was completely different to how it is now. So the first category I decided on was best viral moment of the year. This can be kind of political or otherwise, kind of a something that went worldwide that was either hilarious or powerful or whatever. So what did you choose for best viral moment?
So I kind of went in a different direction. I kind of went for a viral trend, which I think has kind of affected not just like a moment, but the whole year.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like the rise of meme stocks. Like we started with GameStop back in January. We've continued with Dogecoin. We've continued with Hertz, AMC, and you've just seen the stock market kind of go crazy.
You're
going
to have to enlighten me on this.
In this, have you not?
I like to say I'm informed on news and all things news, but you're going to have to inform me.
Well, let me introduce you to January 2021.
Go on.
When GameStop, which is a uninspired, you know, mall games store, essentially.
Right.
Suddenly started going up and up in stock price, and people kept buying in, and this became sort of a trend on Reddit with our Wall Street Bets. I don't know if you've heard of it. Fair enough if you haven't.
That was a kind of muted no, I have heard of it, but
So basically the kind of stock price of GameStop just completely disassociated from the actual business of GameStop, and you ended up with this essentially group of retail traders on Reddit just pushing the stock up and up, forcing all the hedge funds that were kind of short in the stock out of business. Some of them kind of big ones went to bankruptcy. And that trend has just continued throughout the year. You've seen a lot of things with cryptocurrencies that have just gone up and up with no basis in reality. And other stocks like GameStop, like AMC, which is a movie theater chain in the US, which has gone up and up. Out of a pandemic when its, you know, profits are historically low, its stock is sky high.
So where does this have the potential to go, this trend?
Well, that's the thing. I don't know, because most people, I think, thought that this was like a January, February crazy thing, but it kept going, and GameStop now is still really, really high, its stock price. And this could just continue, and it kind of remains to be seen, are stock prices going to get more in line with reality, or is the financial market just going to start getting crazier and crazier?
Do you know what? I'm going to write this down because I want to look at this after this. Honestly, I'm not afraid to admit, I have no idea what you're talking about. But after explanation, I do, obviously. No, that's fascinating. So I kind of took the moment word, the best viral moment of the year, literally. And it was the moment I've chosen, the moment that Piers Morgan decided to walk off Good Morning Britain. I knew when I saw it, I didn't watch it live, but I saw it on the day, and I knew that it would be a viral moment within the UK, but it did reverberate around the world. And not just the act of him walking off, but actually the conversation that preceded it. I'll remind viewers that this occurred within a discussion about the Black Lives Matter movement, and it immediately followed the Meghan Markle and Oprah interview. And Piers Morgan essentially came out and said that he didn't believe anything that she said. And the weather presenter on Good Morning Britain, when Piers was saying this, who happens to be a person of colour, interrupted, you know, completely, well, we're told to believe, completely unrehearsed, interrupted and kind of having a go at Piers Morgan, in response to which Piers Morgan just walked off the set, which has now become a meme online, but actually the political consequences for kind of free discussions about free speech and that kind of thing I thought was so interesting. I saw Piers Morgan on Fox News in America following that, because it means, you know, he quit one of the biggest breakfast shows in the UK. It was a big deal. I thought it was quite a meaningful moment, that one. It certainly went viral.
Yeah, definitely. I think it was almost a bit of a kind of down-to-earth moment of figuring out, okay, so this is who Piers Morgan is. Mm-hmm. Because we've had the last, you know, year and a half or so of Piers Morgan actually really effectively holding the government to account over COVID.
Absolutely.
And everything.
I completely agree.
And then he kind of comes back to what he was before that. And you kind of see that side of him again.
Well, it also shows that people are multifaceted, aren't they? Because people, I think, Piers Morgan is highly controversial. But on the extreme side of things, people construct him as this sort of fascist or something. When actually, throughout the pandemic, I personally believe that Piers Morgan is a heartthrob liberal. And I think he has some particularly controversial views on some topics, including, for some reason, his sort of his obsession with talking about Meghan Markle. Because you're right, during the pandemic, it was Piers Morgan and Susanna Reid on GMB who were bringing those really shocking moments of kind of realisation to viewers when they were interviewing government ministers, so much so that government ministers actually ended up boycotting the show for, I think it was over 100 days. It was crazy. That was my viral moment of the year. You're moving on to interview of the year. I'll go first on this one, then I'll come back to you. So interview of the year, you might notice some of these have a sort of British politics stance. That is what I'm most interested in. But interview of the year, spoilt for choice, I thought, But I actually went for one that people might not have seen. It was the Laura Koonsberg interview with Dominic Cummings. Now, Dominic Cummings, of course, is Boris Johnson's former special advisor in number 10 Downing Street and quit after kind of an almighty row with him. But the reason that I like this interview as an interview, rather than just, you know, being able to hear what Dominic Cummings has to say, is because Dominic Cummings has traditionally been such an elusive figure. He was the brains behind Vote Leave, which of course won the Brexit referendum. And at that time, people were desperate to know who he was. And even once Boris Johnson got into Downing Street in 2019 and Cummings was working in Downing Street with him to strategise on things, Cummings was never public. He didn't do interviews, as is traditional for advisors, of course. That all changed when he drove to Barnard Castle, breaking lockdown rules, and then ended up doing a press conference in the Downing Street Rose Garden. And so this interview between Laura Koonsberg, who is the BBC's political editor, and Dominic Cummings, I thought was fascinating because it was sort of laying bare this personality who has had so much power for the last few years, and yet none of us have ever seen. He said some astonishing things. He said that in the wake of the few days following the 2019 general election, some of the senior advisors in Downing Street were so concerned about Boris Johnson's suitability for the office that they hatched a plot to remove him from office, to which Laura Koonsberg sort of responds, well, what do you mean? You're unelected advisors. Why are you trying to influence a newly elected prime minister? And that kind of thing. It's fantastic. It's an hour long, I believe. It's an hour long interview. I would be surprised if it wasn't still available on BBC iPlayer. And I thought it covered so much of the last few years, all the way back to the Brexit referendum. But also, I think most crucial was what he said about the days at the start of the pandemic. And I think the sort of chaos that ensued Downing Street and those kind of that kind of testimony will certainly be useful for the public inquiry that comes. That was my interview of the year.
Yeah, pretty good.
And what was yours?
My interview was Harry and Meghan's interview with Oprah.
I was going to choose that. I'm glad I didn't.
I haven't actually watched the interview, so it's a bit rich for me to pick it.
Go on.
But I think, you know, just as a statement on how the royal family has kind of evolved in the public eye over the last couple of years, it's an interesting one because we've had this one. We had, you know, the truly shocking interview with Prince Andrew a couple of years ago.
Of course, yes.
And now kind of all the stuff in the press about just this brotherly rivalry between Prince William and Prince Harry. It's just kind of getting a bit weird. Like, there's a lot of scandal floating around that doesn't really have necessarily a footing, but at some point it seems like it is going to all blow up.
Yeah, see, I did watch that interview live, actually.
Okay.
And I must say, I didn't previously think of Oprah to be an interviewer. You know, I know she rose to fame as sort of a chat show host, and she's very good with groups of people and live audiences and that kind of thing. But I didn't know how she would fare in a very obviously high-profile interview. I thought she was fantastic. She basically asked the questions that everyone wanted to know that seemed off-limits. So they would say things. Meghan said, I think the accusation was that a member of the royal family was concerned about her baby Archie's skin before he was born, the colour that it would be before he was born. And Oprah went, because we heard that, and obviously in everyone's mind was the question, well, who said that? Was it a senior member of the royal family? And Oprah asked that question, to which we didn't get an answer, of course. But
I think we were told it wasn't Prince Philip.
We were told it wasn't Prince Philip,
which is a strange
sort of defensive strategy to just rule out one person. But I guess that proves where everyone's mind was leading on that. It certainly shows the way the royal family are changing. Yeah. Scandal of the year. Go on.
So there were so many to pick.
There were so many.
This was a tough choice. But finally, I think I went with Matt Hancock.
It has to be, doesn't it?
That was just such a classic scandal. It was kind of like the pre-Boris normal political scandal. It's like what you expect from politicians as a scandal. And then, I mean, we've had a couple of years of Boris just doing crazy things and no consequences. And then this nice, normal political scandal that leaves him leaving office.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Because what people say about Boris Johnson is that he's a fantastic election winner. But actually, once he gets into government, the standards that he applies to himself and his colleagues are lower than that other prime ministers might have applied. And therefore, he's kind of developed this reputation for his ministers being unsackable. And so even when I saw that front page on The Sun
I thought that was just going to blow over.
I was exactly the same because, you know, it happened with Cummings the year before. And I just thought, you know what? this is a huge scandal. Matt Hancock will become a joke, especially, you know, of people of our age, and he'll, you know, memes will come out about it. But I didn't think he would end up losing his job, particularly as I think the received wisdom before that was that actually of the members of the cabinet throughout the pandemic, Matt Hancock had performed relatively well. So what do you think it was that turned that scandal into a resignation issue? Do you think there was any particular element?
I don't actually know. Like, I'm struggling to kind of get what's unique about that scandal compared to so many others. I can't imagine it's anything more than just either Boris Johnson or his partner not liking Matt Hancock.
I think, well,
it seems like just something as silly as that.
Well, linking back to my interview of the year, one of the things that Dominic Cummings did say was that Carrie Johnson, who is now the Prime Minister's wife, apparently has a lot of influence in government, or at least influence, not in government, but over the decisions that Johnson makes. And obviously we have no idea if that's true or not. But for me, I think the reason that the Hancock scandal turned into a resignation was because of the footage. I think if The Sun had published a story saying Matt Hancock was seen snogging someone in the Department of Health office, I think it would have been a big story. But oh my God, that picture is haunting. The picture.
Yeah.
And then
you can't really get past that, can you?
You really can't. And the way they delivered this story, was it The Sun or was it the Mail?
I think it was The Sun.
I think it was The Sun. Because the way they did it is they gave us the still image on one morning. The scandal obviously erupted. And then I think it was the next day or maybe 3 days after, they released the video footage, which was even more harrowing because you could see Matt Hancock doing things that no one wants to see Matt Hancock doing. And I think it was the fact that Hancock became a joke after that. I don't know if people were that bothered about him spending time kissing someone in the office. I do think it was the fact that actually the government's credibility, if one of the senior members of cabinet is getting up to that thing and is on tape doing so, the government's credibility is shot. I think that's what did it.
It is interesting as well because, like, the only element that's really a scandal is that it's an affair. But we know that Boris Johnson has had so many affairs over his life. So why is that not affecting him? Like, where is that kind of morality coming from? Like, why is
Absolutely.
It? So it's interesting.
And it has to be said that scandals do affect people in different ways, and that Matt Hancock's existing family, his wife, were treated badly by the press in the wake of this. You know, photographers outside their house, which is not nice. So obviously, I wanted to choose that. Being, you know, since you've chosen that, I think rather than a scandal of the year, I think there have been a series of scandals, of which the Matt Hancock affair was one, that just show a pattern in government that I think might be starting to bother voters. So people call it sleaze, they call it, you know, standards. Some people even call it corruption, although that is, of course, a proper accusation. I'm not calling it that. But so let's call it sleaze. So you had Matt Hancock, then you had the issue of who paid for the Prime Minister's holiday, because apparently that was a Conservative Party donor. Then you had, if you remember, the Downing Street flat refurbishment. Apparently a political donor paid for that as well, whereas, of course, Downing Street is a government building, so that shouldn't be happening. Then you had, if you remember, in the summer, during the so-called pingdemic, when everyone was being told to isolate, the Prime Minister and the Chancellor were told to isolate and then immediately were enrolled onto a so-called pilot scheme, whereby if you were pinged, you didn't need to isolate. And so people had a problem with that. Of course, most recently, we've had the Owen Paterson and Jeffrey Cox stuff about second jobs and lobbying and that kind of thing. So I think, and this is reflected in the Labour Party's new attack lines, I think a point of weakness of the government is the attack line that it's one rule for them and another rule for everyone else. Would you agree?
Yeah, and I think the new revelations about the Christmas parties in Downing Street that have just come out are just another kind of nail in that coffin.
Yeah, and I think the reason that these stories have been sticking this year more than most is because, let's take the newly released one just a few days ago about, just for those who are unfamiliar, last year it said that last year on the 18th of December, Downing Street staff threw a party when, of course, at that point, the rest of the country was in lockdown. And I think that was it. I think it's because the government, at the same time as all of this has been going on, have been asking members of the public to obey quite strict regulations on their way of life. And I think that's what's been bothering people. Maybe the lobbying stuff wouldn't have stuck so much if that wasn't the case. I don't know. But yeah, we haven't been denied scandals this year, let's just say. So The next category I chose was new face on the block. Now, have you chosen a political person or?
I couldn't think of anything.
You couldn't think of anyone. I struggled. I must say, this is the one I struggled with the most. I ended up going for Anna Sawa, who is the new Scottish Labour leader. Mm-hmm. I picked him because, well, firstly, because Scottish politics, in terms of the personalities at the top of it, has been rather relatively static, if you exclude Labour, over the last few years. So, obviously, Nicola Sturgeon has been the leader of the SNP for a very long time, since 2014. Willie Rennie has been the leader of the Liberal Democrats. He's now stood down, but since 2012 or something crazy. And Labour have sort of been churning through their leaders. And I think Anna Sawa, because obviously we had the Scottish elections in May of this year, and I think in the television debates prior to that, I do think Anna Sawa was a breath of fresh air for people. Just in his approach to making arguments, he seemed to sort of rise above the hatred that Nicola Sturgeon and Douglas Ross, who is the leader of the Conservatives, clearly have for one another. I don't know how much you followed those elections, or did you get that impression from him? Were you not impressed by him?
You know, I found that odd because there was so much coming out about Douglas Ross at the time that I didn't very much understand quite a lot of the attack lines that were going.
You did or didn't?
I did. I mean, especially his stuff about gypsies, like that was, you know, beyond the pale.
Yes, he said that if he was Prime Minister for the day, he would increase sort of laws surrounding travellers.
I can't actually recall the specific kind of thing. Yeah. But it did seem like it was Labour in a new light. It was Scottish Labour. It wasn't just like a shadow of UK Labour.
Which it needs to be, doesn't it? It needs to be different from UK Labour.
Yeah, because I still remember in 2015 in the general election when we had one Labour MP in the entirety of Scotland. Like that is...
Oh, that's the same now. There's one Labour MP. Ian Murray is the only Labour MP in Scotland.
Yeah. Yes. Uh-huh. But it went up and... I mean,
yeah,
had
yeah,
so many elections
went up in 2017
and then
down. Yeah.
But like that moment was just like a... Because Labour had been so strong in Scotland and then it just dropped. And it's nice to see Scottish Labour trying to kind of forge its own path apart from UK Labour.
Sure.
So what do you think
Anna Sawa does with Scottish Labour now? What is their purpose? Is it to be an outright anti-independence party? Or is it to try and pursue the strategy that he seemingly did in May, which was to kind of rise above that and say, actually, don't think about independence. This is what matters more. And talk about...
You know, I actually think, like... using Labour as a platform against independence is a real bad move in Scotland because you've got the really good attack line, which is that's Labour and the Conservatives teaming up, which is not something that any, you know, Labour voter wants to actually hear. And if you say Labour is an anti-independence party, the Conservatives are an anti-independence party, then you leave about half the country for just the SNP and the Greens. And like, where does that leave? That's just Labour and the Conservatives fighting over the scraps of that.
Yeah, and
there's no kind of positive message for Scotland there. It's just a negative one of independence is bad.
And
what is Labour actually for?
This throws up the issue that Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn had, because it throws up the issue of a referendum, which is direct democracy, versus elections, which is representative democracy. Because in 2019, Boris Johnson... The country on Brexit was virtually 50-50 split. The reason Boris Johnson won the 2019 general election was because he managed to get, I think, over 80% of leavers to vote for him, whereas the Remain vote was left split, as you say, between Labour, the Lib Dems, the SNP, etc. And Nicola Sturgeon, however much you might hate Boris Johnson, is obviously trying to pursue a similar strategy and shore up those... by gaining a parliamentary majority, by shoring up the independence vote.
Yeah, and it's not a bad... It's a very effective strategy. I mean, Boris Johnson showed its power.
Yeah, and you're right. I think the Conservatives in Scotland have managed to gain a brand for themselves in the last few years as being the anti-unionist, anti-independence party. And I think they're proud of that. I don't think Labour will feel comfortable doing that.
I think the Conservatives in Scotland did very well under Ruth Davidson, and I worry that Douglas Ross is taking them in a very different direction. And it does seem like that sort of kind of brand they built up under Ruth Davidson is going to disappear.
Mm.
Because Douglas Ross doesn't seem to be able to muster the same sense of like a Scottish Conservatives different from the UK Conservatives that Ruth Davidson was.
But there will come a time when Anna Sawa and Scottish Labour will have to make up their minds about independence. Obviously, they formally have. The party stance is that they are anti-independence. But there will come a time when he has to start campaigning. He has to be passionate on this issue.
Yeah, and then at that point, we'll have Labour and the Conservatives teaming up again. And that will be the same kind of effect in Scottish Labour as it was the last time. So where does that leave Scottish Labour in the long run? I don't know.
Yeah, lots to think about, lots to think about. Well, we're going to take a pause from our awards, our review of 2021. It was a year not just of news, of course, but of new music. And we've chosen two tracks today to play for you, new releases from this year that we like. Samuel, I've picked your one to go first, so if you'd like to go ahead and introduce it yourself and why you've chosen it.
This is Good For You by Olivia Rodrigo. It's just a good track.
It is a great track.
For you, I guess you moved on really easily. You found a new girl and it only took a couple weeks. Remember when you said that you wanted to give me the world? And good for you, I guess that you've been working on yourself. I guess the therapist I found for you, she really helped. Now you can be a better man for your brand new girl. For you, I guess you're getting everything you want. You bought a new car and your career's really taking off. It's like we never even happened, baby. Tell me what is up with that. And good for you, it's like you never even met me. Remember when you swore to God I was the only person who ever got you? Well, screw that and screw you. You will never have to hurt the way you know that I do.
And that was Olivia Rodrigo with Good For You. A good choice, I would say.
Thank you. Very good choice.
I enjoyed her album. So, moving on back to our... If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Fresh Air News Hour with me, Ollie Lewis, and our station manager, Samuel McLeod. Pleasure to be with you. We're doing a kind of news and politics review of 2021. So far, we've looked at the best viral moment of the year, the interview of the year, scandal of the year, and kind of the new face on the block of politics. Now, speech of the year is the next category I've chosen. Would you like to go first, Samuel?
Sure. Well, I think, I mean, I've got two, but I'll go with the fun one first, which go I on. Think is Boris Johnson's Peppa Pig speech.
Oh, of
which
course.
Which was just inspirational, you know?
Oh, wow. Yeah.
That was just a crazy moment.
So what I don't know was the Peppa Pig thing part of the speech?
Yes, it was about the power of British industry.
So, but that was written down. He didn't come up with that off the cuff.
He may have come up with it off the cuff, but it was part of what the speech he was giving.
Yeah.
Like, he made car noises. It was just... It was amazing.
Thing is, but that is brand Boris, isn't it?
It is brand Boris, but it was like brand Boris at its best. It was totally Boris.
Yeah, but and also, obviously, speeches do... generally need to be tailored to their audience, and that was an audience with the Confederation of British Industry.
I would imagine Peppa Pig is not exactly the sort of thing they'd want to be hearing.
No, no. Go on, what was your next one?
So my next one was, it was a poem by Amanda Gorman.
Yes.
At Biden's inauguration. Yes. And I thought this was just such a good kind of showcase of the difference of Biden's presidency, I guess. It was a really impactful poem. I remember watching it live with my US family, and my goodness, it was just such a powerful moment.
You have American family, do you?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was just such a powerful moment to just kind of hear that and see that, and then, you know, call my grandparents in the States, and like, this is a different moment for America. And it really did feel like that.
For people who might not have seen that speech, obviously they should go and watch it. But it wasn't a speech, as you said, it was a poem. Kind of, what was the thrust of it? Why was it so impressive for you?
I think it was just kind of about hope. You know, it was called The Hill We Climb. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of just about hope, equality, harmony. And it was just such a different message than what you'd get out of a Trump presidency.
Mm. Yeah, the whole inauguration actually was a real major political event in my mind. I mean, obviously, it in structural terms, it was a major political event in that Joe Biden assumed the presidency. But I remember I watched the inauguration with my flatmates and some of my friends, one of which is American. And it was a real kind of occasion. The kind of the outfits, the way they walk through those doors, the way their names are announced. It's kind of, what struck me was actually that, of course, they don't have a royal family in the US. There's no monarchy. There's no kind of group of people who are generally respected above everyone else, or thought to be on a different scale, kind of personally. I'm not articulating this particularly well, but what I realised looking at that stage, actually, this is the American royal family.
Yeah.
The Clintons, the Bushes, the Obamas, and many people would argue that kind of sense of cliqueiness, of Washington establishment feeling, was what drove Donald Trump's candidacy. And actually a disdain for those kind of people who have spent their lives in Washington. But yeah, that's what struck me. It was a really enjoyable occasion to watch, I think, especially considering that it was able to go ahead during the pandemic. And since that was your speech of the year, actually, coincidentally, I actually chose Joe Biden's inauguration speech.
Oh, very good.
Yeah, because I thought, firstly, the issue you said about kind of the themes involved, hope and new beginnings and that kind of thing, were impressive. But I thought, I think regardless of party affiliation, it was Joe Biden at his best, because throughout the campaign, especially in the early days, people were saying that Joe Biden was just mentally not up to the job. They were saying that he hides in his basement and that he's incapable of giving speeches. You know, he would give kind of virtual press conferences from his basement in Delaware. So these accusations were not unfounded. There was a concern among Democrats that actually, is this the right time to be having a 77-year-old run for president?
Mm-hmm.
But actually, I think the speech, his victory speech that he and Vice President Kamala Harris gave, were outstandingly delivered, as was his inauguration speech. It's about 20 minutes long. And I, again, if people haven't seen it, I really would recommend people go and watch it. Because I think I must have watched at least the last five first inauguration speeches. So Biden, Trump, Obama's first one, Bush's first one, and Clinton's first one. And they're always such a big moment, because they set the tone, don't they? They set the tone for the 4 years that are to come. So Trump used his as an opportunity to declare that, you know, he said, quote, "the American carnage stops right here and right now," and that kind of thing, whatever that meant. We weren't quite sure, but, and whether you hated him for that or loved him for that, you understood the power of that moment because of the speech. And I think that's exactly what Biden achieved. He achieved a sense of new beginnings. And yeah, I really enjoyed that day. I thought it was a fantastic show of oratory skill. Just because you chose to, I would also note the speech by a conservative MP called Tom Tugendhat during the Afghanistan crisis. This was, Tom Tugendhat is a former, he served in the military, and Tom Tugendhat gave a fantastic speech in Parliament about how wrong everything went, and how on earth they got to this point, and the stories he spoke about of being able to help people in Afghanistan, and how all of that was sort of being lost with the quick withdrawal and the advancement of the Taliban. So if people are looking for speeches, go and look for that one as well. Right, so moving on to Journalist of the Year. Quite a broad category. Can be a journalist from anywhere in the world. Who did you choose?
Do you want to go first? I think I
took Okay, of course. So I chose Amol Rajan, who people might not have heard of. I don't know. Amol Rajan works for the BBC. He is the former, I want to say, executive editor or editor-in-chief of The Independent. But he is now the BBC's media editor, and he is also a presenter on the Radio 4 Today programme, which is sort of the flagship radio news show on the BBC. He is a breath of fresh air, I think. I first came across him, actually, in an interview he did with Andrew Neil, just before GB News launched. Of course, GB News being Andrew Neil's brand new channel, which he left within 2 weeks because he didn't like the content. But actually, Amol Rajan, being, I think, under 30, or if not very much older than 30, he was interviewing Andrew Neil about GB News and about the new channel. And similarly to Oprah, as we were talking about earlier during our discussion about Interview of the Year, Amol Rajan just asked the questions that we wanted to hear. He got to the detail of things. He did it in a way that was fearless, but also polite and succinct. And actually, there is speculation that Laura Koonsberg, as the BBC's political editor, will be standing down soon. And I think whether my money's on him to replace her, I don't know. But I have no doubt that he would be a fantastic appointment. I think he's scrupulously impartial. He's incredibly eloquent. He's been brilliant on the short time that he's done the Today programme. And yeah, he's my Journalist of the Year, Amol Rajan. And I think definitely one to watch and a huge inspiration for someone who wants to go into political journalism like me.
Yeah, wow. Well, my pick was James O'Brien, who's a host on LBC Radio in London.
Go on.
And I think he hosts a kind of call-in show every day. And I think essentially it's the way he handles calls that make me, you know, pick him as Journalist of the Year. He has this talent of just getting to the thrust of a caller's argument, of kind of questioning it and breaking it down. And it's really interesting to kind of hear, you know, this spectrum of the UK and UK political opinions and just kind of have them dissected.
Mm. Yeah, so I am a huge fan of LBC Radio. Of all the presenters, of all the shows, I think the format is fantastic. And yeah, James O'Brien is one that I listen to very, very regularly. And interestingly, he is usually the one that from LBC that goes viral, isn't he?
He is, yeah. There's a lot of kind of viral clips of him on YouTube and Twitter.
Yeah. What do you say to the criticism of him that he's patronising with callers? That someone will call in trying to make an argument, and, you know, it can be nerve-wracking. We're on student radio right now, but even this, you know, we're watching what we say. It's difficult to articulate things sometimes. Yeah. And he has people call into his show, because that's the format of LBC, to contribute. This happened a lot during Brexit, and people would criticise him for dismissing people and kind of manipulating what they're saying and putting words in their mouth. What do you think about that?
I think it's kind of unfair. I mean, the base of it is that he isn't... it is kind of somewhat opinion-based journalism. It's not kind of scrupulously independent, Absolutely. Impartial, like the BBC would be. But I think, at a base level, he's got an understanding he wants to get of the caller's argument, and he's trying to get that. He's not trying to catch them out. He's not trying to catch them out. He's not trying to make fun of them. You know, he's trying to understand what they're saying, and he's using the questions that he needs to use in the short time that he has to find that. And I don't think he is trying to be patronising. I don't think he is trying to put people down. I think he's just trying to get to the crux of what their argument is.
Mm. He has two fantastic books as well. I don't know if you've read them, but it's actually about the way he has changed his mind on certain issues and the way that he approaches certain issues. And it's really interesting. Talking about LBC, it is worth mentioning when we're talking about Journalist of the Year that Andrew Marr is leaving the BBC after 20 years or so or more to head to LBC, which will be so interesting, I think, because the Andrew Marr show, which is the BBC Sunday morning show, which is virtually guaranteed a government representative and an opposition representative. It's probably the most high-profile television politics show. And for years, we've seen him interrogate politicians, quote-unquote, impartially, haven't we? Mm-hmm. And now he's going to LBC and he's going to be articulating exactly what he thinks. I think it's going to be so interesting.
It's interesting, because it does seem like he's made this move because he wants to break out of the impartiality.
I think he said that, yeah.
He did, and I think especially on climate issues he mentioned that he wants to speak more
about
that.
Oh, did he say that? Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah, I think he's... Because he does a lot of kind of history programmes and documentaries and stuff as well. He's a really interesting character, and I'll be fascinated to see what he thinks. So, moving on to story/scoop of the year. Go on. Have we I'll let you go first.
Sure. Well, I had a fairly boring one, to be honest. We've already touched on it, actually.
Yeah,
I think it's The Sun with Matt Hancock.
Same. That's exactly what I chose. I'm now frantically trying to think of another one off the top of my head. Yeah, I do think that newspapers have led the news agenda this year to a large extent. I think on all sides of the political spectrum. And what's really interesting is that the story that really damaged the government, the Matt Hancock one, was broken by The Sun, which is obviously a right-wing newspaper. And so that really defeats the accusation that it's all partisan witch hunt, attack.
I mean, to some extent, like...
Of course it is. They have a motivation.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what print journalism is in this country. The Guardian and The Mirror have done fantastic work this year as well on setting the news agenda.
I think The Mirror broke the Christmas party story.
They did. Pippa Kerr of The Mirror has been breaking some fantastic stories. But also, I think one to watch for 2022 is The Daily Mail. Not only are they having a new editor, but there has been a slow creeping of opinion, I think, on the front page of The Daily Mail that is becoming ever more critical of Boris Johnson as an individual. Whether they're becoming more critical of the Conservatives or Conservative ideology is a different question. But I think whether it's individuals within the Mail or whether it's the publication as a whole, I think they are perhaps reflecting a feeling in the country of slight frustration with Boris Johnson. And that actually the joke of his personality, which many people adore, might be wearing slightly thin. I don't know if you agree with that.
The Mail's an interesting one because they're kind of the archetype of like the right-wing British tabloid. And they were so instrumental in leading up to Brexit with how much they pushed that. And I don't know necessarily if they're going to go away from, right-wing conservatism, but it does seem like they're pushing against Boris Johnson specifically.
Mm.
And I wonder where that's going to lead because they were such... The Daily Mail and The Sun kind of were a big part of what got Boris Johnson into power in the first place. And so if they kind of renege on that, then what's going to happen?
And I think... With papers like that, particularly those on the right, they set the agenda and they follow where they think public opinion is going. They want to be on the right side of history. They don't want to go into an election supporting a candidate or a party which then loses. And so you saw this with The Sun. It was so interesting obviously read and watched about it. I wasn't there. But in the late 90s, Tony Blair got The Sun on side, which sounds phenomenal to say today, given The Sun's editorial line about Labour. A Labour leader was endorsed by The Sun on the front page, and I genuinely think that had such a huge impact on swaying what people would call Middle England, potentially patronisingly. I don't know, but yeah, I don't think it's a short-term issue for Johnson that the Mail is becoming slightly more critical of him, but I think in the long term, people in Downing Street might be thinking, right, so why are they becoming more critical? It's going to be interesting to see next year, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. I do wonder as well if Johnson is going to manage to live out his term, because it would seem bizarre for the Conservatives to kick out, the Prime Minister while they have an overwhelming majority. But there does seem to be a lot of anti-Johnson pressure within the Conservative Party.
So there does.
If that's going to go anywhere.
And I've been wondering this, and it's clear now that the Conservative Party is split into... roughly three groups. You've got the government and the cabinet and those who are clearly behind Boris Johnson. But then on the back benches, those who aren't in government, you kind of have two groups of pretty opposed people. You have the traditional Tory backbenchers you would think of. People like Bernard Jenkin, that kind of thing, who are traditional conservatives, but who are now critical of Boris Johnson, particularly because of the way the government's acted during the pandemic. And I think they've been consistently critical of lockdown and that kind of thing. And they're critical at the moment of the new regulation to bring back masks in England. But then on the other side of that, you have the 2019 intake. Because people, you need to remember that the Conservative Party expanded by about 70 MPs in 2019, much of them from the north of England, much of them younger MPs, much of them from a more working class background, which many people would say is a fantastic thing to have more diverse representation in Parliament. But it does pose a problem for Boris Johnson, because if you are leading a party that is divided between two types of people on some pretty key issues, it is going to throw up some problems. And whether he will live out his parliamentary term is a fantastic question, one to which I do not have the answer. all I would say is this. I think Boris Johnson is an election winner. He won 2 terms as Mayor of London. He won, I believe, played a huge part in winning the Brexit referendum. He won the 2019 general election with a huge majority. And many Tory MPs owe their careers to Boris Johnson. They're in office because of him, especially the 29 intake. So when it comes to it, whether they will actually be prepared to throw him under the bus, I'm not sure. I think he's got one more election in him, but we'll see.
We'll see, yeah.
So the last one is a very broad category. We're in the last 10 minutes of the show now, and that is Achievement of the Year. Did I go for... I'm losing track of things. Did I go first on this one?
I think that's you.
Go on. Okay, so I have two.
Okay.
One of which is very broad, but I think it absolutely deserves a mention in a 2021 news review, and that is the vaccination development and rollout. I think, especially at the start of the year, we were so far ahead of so many countries in the rollout. It was fantastic that some of them were developed in this country. And if you're thinking about achievements of this year and indeed the year before, then developing a life-saving vaccine has to be up there. But I think this one is slightly political, less so. But it's the achievement of the England team at the Euro 2020. People can't tell from my accent. I am English. I do have Scottish family and Welsh family, but I do live in England.
I was cheering for Italy in that match.
Really? Oh, dear. Good job you told me that at the end of the programme. That was just a real... One of those moments where everything just comes together. Everyone just comes together in the country. I thought, well, frankly, not everyone. But and the way that Gareth Southgate managed to rally people behind the England team, I thought was fantastic. And it sort of exemplified a sense of positive patriotism and positive passionate belief in a country that hasn't been articulated in that kind of way for many years. So those are my two achievements of the year. What were yours?
I do think it was interesting as well, there was a lot of ugly kind of racism online that came out afterwards about penalty shootouts, but it was nice to see the pushback against that, which is so often rare.
I think
almost like a turn. It was funny, there was a kind of turnaround in government speaking about racism within football in a way that was completely separate to how they'd spoken about the English team taking the knee earlier in the season. And it was interesting to see that
Gareth Southgate and the England team were able to set the agenda on that issue, which as sports people is kind of unheard of.
Absolutely, because they kind of pushed the government to just take a different line on it, which
was
amazing.
Achievement. Yeah, so interesting. Was that your one? Or
No.
So your achievement.
So my achievement of the year was, again, kind of a broad one. I think it's kind of just getting, for social media companies to recognise a bit more of the impact they have in the world.
Okay.
Because we saw on the 6th of January, obviously, the horrendous attacks in the US Capitol. Mm-hmm. And after that, you saw very, very quickly banning of Donald Trump from Facebook, Twitter, and a lot more banning of kind of inflammatory... calls to violence on social media. And they're not there yet. It's not perfect. And there have been many, many, many concerns over the year. But it is interesting to see all of these platforms start to take a bit more seriously the kind of the responsibility they have to moderate discussion on them and to keep discussion, above, racism, discrimination, calls to violence.
Absolutely. And I often say that, this is a story that will follow in the months and years to come, but that is true so much
for
that story
for decades,
and it will continue to develop. Donald Trump will be back, other people like him will be back, and this discussion about the role that social media companies have as a platform for those kind of sentiments and disinformation and that kind of thing is so interesting. So you'd call that an achievement?
I think it's more an achievement that it's gone a bit. Like the acknowledgement that Donald Trump was a character that should be blocked on Facebook, on Twitter, and the acknowledgement that some of the kind of language and verbiage around that wasn't acceptable on these public platforms was, I think, an achievement.
Wonderful. Well, I always say this, and I can't believe I'm saying it again, but we've reached the end of the show already. The hour goes so quickly.
Wow.
Simon, this is the first time you've been on the News Hour. You've been fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure, and I hope you enjoyed being in the studio rather than managing the station as you do so well. This is my last show for this semester. I will be back next semester, permitting that I'm allowed by you. I've absolutely loved... these last few weeks. This has been my first time ever doing live radio, and I'm so passionate about news, about politics, and about promoting people's voices. And we've had some fantastic reporting and analysis and discussion on the Fresh Air News Hour, and I can't wait to do plenty more of it next term. Now, you played a song earlier from this year, a new release that you loved, and I'm going to do the same now to play us out. In case you don't know this by now, I do enjoy my Taylor Swift, and this has been a year for Taylor Swift. She is re-releasing all of her albums, and I'm going to give you one of the actual proper new releases rather than a re-recorded song. This is Mr. Perfectly Fine, which is from the Fearless Taylor's Version album, and it's going to be playing us out today. Thank you so much for listening. It's been an absolute pleasure to be with you, and I will of course be back next semester with more news analysis and discussion on the Fresh Air News Hour. I've been Ollie Lewis, and I'll see you very soon. Goodbye.
Mr. Perfect Face, Mr. Here to Stay, Mr. Looked me in the eye and told me you would never go away. Everything was right, Mr. I've been waiting for you all my life, Mr. Every single day until the end I will be by your side. But that was when I got to know Mr. Change of Heart. Mr. Leaves me all alone, I fall apart. It takes everything in me just to get up each day, but it's wonderful to see that you're okay. Hello, Mr. Perfectly Fine, how's your heart after breaking mine? Mr. Always at the right place at the right time, baby. Hello, Mr. Casually Cruel, Mr. Everything revolves around you. I've been misery since your goodbye, and you're Mr. Perfectly to stay. Now I miss gonna be alright someday, and some
before.